Hello and welcome to Keyframes, a podcast about anime. I'm your host, Ben Halliburton, and with me today is Duncan.
Hey there.
And John.
Hi, I'm a big fan of guns.
And planes, and tanks.
Oh yeah, and all the other military
and
stuff.
And tracks, and ships, and aircraft carriers, and submarines.
Mostly them guns, though, them murder machines.
Well, yeah, like, a submarine is a gun by other means, I suppose.
I mean, what is not a gun? If you put all your efforts and guts into it, anything can be a gun.
Yes, yes. Humanity has only invented one object, and it is a gun. Everything is just permutations.
Stolen from the gods.
Just want a gun to shoot God and fix this reality. We are talking about military anime or military hardware in anime. I think we're going to see that these three different hosts have three different interpretations of what was admittedly a very vague topic. But if you've been following this podcast, you have noticed that I enjoy the aesthetics of weapons of war, and I think that is common among a lot of anime creators. Like, my man Hideki Anno has that famous quote from his 2014 interview where he says there's a beauty in unadorned functionality totally separate from a weapon of war. Fighter planes and battleships have a simple function, but they don't want to see them killing people, but just like flying or sailing around. It's pretty rad. And also, I guess they can kill some people, but like aliens that we will understand later and make peace with.
Only if it looks cool and isn't tragic.
Yeah.
Or tragic, but like in a way that motivates the protagonist to heroically pacifist later. just constantly alluding to several different anime that we will certainly be talking about. Yeah. Anyway, I picked this just because I watch a lot of tanks and ships and airplane anime. I even watch ones that are mediocre, like Magnificent Kotobuki and Sigurd Drifa and Girly Air Force, which I will be bringing up later in light of Strike Witches. Spoilers. But Duncan, how did you take away from this topic?
For me, like military stuff has always been like one of those things where my particular kind of brain can lock onto it. I think I've spoken before, like how when I was like 7 or 8, and we were in a bookstore which was having a closing down sale, and my grandma said to me, "Okay, you can pick any book you want." And so obviously, child me went, "Okay, what is the largest book I can find?" And I found a Jane's Fighting Ships of World War II, which has all the silhouettes, the weights, the caliber of guns, every single fact a small child could wish about ships in it. And I was very happy with my purchase, I must tell you, Ben. And military has maintained that fascination to me throughout. Like what you were saying about Anno is we build these things to kill, but they are as object watching a Vulcan bomber fly by this giant wing, which was just built to drop nuclear bombs. Mm-hmm. And just that flying over me as a kid at an air show, and just these engines just drowning out everything. And there's something to these objects, which is kind of awesome in the awe.
In the literal sense. Yeah. Yeah. Awesome and awful.
Yeah. I think fundamentally the reason we see so much military stuff in anime and in all media, frankly, is because like drama is conflict. But so like there's absolutely no surprise that war and everything surrounding it is one of the most common subjects people turn to. But we did say that this is specifically not about war. This is about the military. And I think like it's important to talk about what makes a military. And to me, it's the systemization. It's fundamentally, a military is a machine to weigh the scales so overwhelmingly in your favor that the fight itself is almost predetermined by the time it happens. Mm-hmm. It's a professional and cold way of doing things, a rejection of the individual warrior in favor of the army. It's people walking in ranks, it's massed formations. That's the military. It's not the hero. But that's kind of the problem that a lot of anime and other media run into when telling the stories, that humans don't really like that story. They don't like being told you're just a number.
Yeah.
You have no personal agency. Your fate is pretty much resolved the moment you're shipped out to wherever. And so very often, they just don't tell that story. Humans want to feel significant. We want a hero to cheer for. So combat aces and the special units, those are where we go so often. So there's someone to cheer for.
Top Gun. Oh, that's not anime, but you know. what it made me think of, sorry.
Anime, please.
Top Gun the anime.
Top Gun is pretty anime in terms of homoeroticism, and it's just like open-mouthed appreciation for the beauty of the F-14 Tomcat. So,
if Jeff was here, he would tell you Bang Bang Braven is Top Gun for giant robos, and he'd be right. It's one of the many reasons you should watch that show.
He'd also talk about the Avro Arrow, I'm sure, you know, because Canadians.
They gotta have
it's
their pride.
It's a joke for my plane nerds out there. What's up?
But yeah, it's like to give myself like a lens to get this all encompassing thing. The way I've done it is like just to think about the different ways individual could just like pass through it. How the way that most of us experience the military is through its just pervasive effect in culture, which is a very meta way to start. So you have to have shows which are pretty self-facing to do that, because not all propaganda is just your country needs you. We've partly talked about this beforehand, is that I'm not entirely happy with the word propaganda here, because the way the military has seeped into culture and the way it's sanitized and promoted isn't as overt as propaganda or as targeted as propaganda, but it is normalized and it is systemized.
I would argue that that's literally what propaganda is.
We had a little bit of a talk about this before the podcast started. I do think I can see, like, Duncan sees propaganda as overt and deliberate, while John sees, like, you can have propaganda that has existed for so long that it's like kind of dissolved into the water supply. And the idea that having the best tanks and the best planes, and we're not going to fight, but if we do fight, we're just going to completely wreck the shit out of you, that's like implicit cultural propaganda.
We don't want to fight you, but by jingo if we do.
Like, if you ask me, I'd say Call of Duty is propaganda. Like, it's 100%. Like,
yeah,
the celebration of the military, of America specifically, just always winning everything. It doesn't have to be directly from the government. I don't think it has to be explicitly a pro thing. It just has
cultural note that's struck various contexts. And sometimes that is because the army is giving money to the Call of Duty or to the Marvel studios, which is kind of why it's interesting to watch Militaria that is Japan centric, even though the JSDF has, I believe, funded or at least like provided close consulting on many anime. Not to bring up Zapang, my mid darling, but that one was made in close cooperation with the Japanese Navy to like make it a realistic, slightly futuristic carrier. And the pitch is always that, like, oh, we're going for accuracy, so we're going with the people who know, the army. But there's accuracy and then there's accuracy. I think we can all agree. But it's still interesting to, like, with, like, I'm going to talk about it in a bit. I'll find a way to wedge it in. But, like, Strike Witches, the specific genre of military anime that cropped up in the late 2000s, early 2010s, where you have these, like, transnational coalitions of cute girls who all, like, represent their country. And in the case of Strike Witches, there are, like, a couple of Germans and a couple of British and a couple of Japanese. And so they can, you know, capture, like, the hard, martial, katana-wielding Japanese and the, like, soft, loving post-war Japanese who don't want to shoot anybody. But there is this kind of, like, dilution of nationalistic propaganda by making these military-focused anime about these, like, international forces coming together. And it feels less propagandistic because it moves away from, like, our nation is the best and we can beat all the other nations to, like, humanity has to work together by shooting aliens. And then it turns out the aliens don't want to fight either. Spoilers. Sorry. But you knew that was going to happen. Like, no, like, the upshot of these is that fighting is unnecessary almost always. I feel like it's actually kind of interesting in a lot of military anime that the war is a lie. I don't know if that's a post-Iraq war sort of
no,
global perspective, or if it is just
One thing I was going to bring up in a later section was Nausicaa, which we talked about in the Ghibli episode, which is, I think, is an anime which has set kind of the template. Mm. This war has ground generation of people into dust, and this has to be stopped. Nausicaa is a heroine because she stops the war, not because she's going to win it. That particular template, you can find it in things like your recent Bete Noir and Zammed, and a show I will talk about later, Last Exile.
Oh God, am I going to be made to? Oh, okay. I was worried you're going to make me talk more about Zammed.
No, don't worry.
I'm fine on Zammed. Okay, yeah. Sorry, I panicked for a second.
No.
It's fine. I like a lot of the constituent parts. What a weird anime. And yeah.
When did Strike Witches come out? I'm just curious.
Made in 2007, released in 2008. Like, all the copyrights are for 2007 because that's when the demo OVA came out. But I think it's 2008. It's the first one. And then Upote is later, and then Girls and Panzers later. And that's the same consulting group.
The reason I ask, and God forbid, I really didn't want to talk about Gate, but I'm bringing up Gate now.
You were always gonna talk about Gate. Let's not fool ourselves.
I don't want to.
but the JSGF does want you to, John.
Yeah, no, that's definitely a show that's very, very happy to celebrate the Japanese Self-Defense Force. Shows them taking on every other country's special defense force. Like,
of course,
it's interesting bringing that, or you talking about Strike Witches and how like it's inevitable that the war was not wanted by anyone, but Gate is very much the opposite of that, where that war is forced upon humanity, and then they all come together, but then they also all fight about it because, you know, humanity can't get along. I don't know if I really had more to say than that. Gate sucks, but it's very, very gung-ho.
But you talk about it constantly.
You guys kind of force it on me, to be fair.
I guess we did make you come on an anime podcast about a military anime, so
yeah.
I mean,
yeah, it's your fault.
I'll take responsibility.
Yeah.
Not usually the context you hear that for anime.
Yeah, but yeah, Gate's very much like a celebration of all of that shit. It's not at all a condemnation. It's not at all we don't really want to fight. It's we're gonna fight because we have to, and we're gonna win because we can.
Mm.
It's interesting putting that like up against Strike Witches that you're talking about, and Nausicaa also, like where war, like I know we said we don't want it to be quite about war, but where those conflicts are oppressive and generation destroying.
Yeah. Yeah. I mean, that was one of the most pleasant surprises with Strike Witches. Let's talk about Strike Witches, fine. is that like the older generation of the girls, of the girls who don't wear pants because they have airplane legs and are
you
are
keep
magic.
Saying this. I don't know what Strike Witches looks like, but it's putting images in my head.
So the wild thing about Strike Witches is it came out relatively early in the big like wave of military anime, and it feels like an industry out of ideas and just throwing together a million different things. Because like their magic, they have healing magic, and they can like cast shields that block lasers from the aliens, and they wear airplane legs, and they don't have pants, and they have like nation specific guns, and they're all named after aces. And there's this one girl, and she doesn't want to fight. She's convinced it's for the greater good.
Okay, but the thing I keep getting stuck on, what the fuck is an airplane leg? Like, what does that mean?
They're like imagine you just take an airplane and you cut off the tail, reduce the wings drastically, and then you stick your foot where you cut off the tail until it goes all the way up to your panties, which are on display. And that is an airplane leg. And you have two of those, and they also require magic. Like, there's like a weird like shining energy effect as they put their legs inside the airplane. The airplane pants.
Amazing. Okay. I'm just gonna
It's amazing. It's really weird to watch this. I always thought that this was the dumb one. No offense to anyone who liked Strike Witch. I mean, I'm probably gonna say a lot of things that disparage your taste, but I say it out of love. I always avoided this one, and I feel largely vindicated because for the most part, it's just slice of life with different national stereotypes hanging out. There's an Italian girl who like sleeps all the time and is lazy and a glutton, and she steals stuff, and that's mood. And there's another sleepy girl who's Finnish. I like an anime with two different archetypes of sleepy girls. But anyway, like, but what's really interesting about it is just that like it seems like the war angle is largely superfluous. It comes in, it starts out the first two episodes when she's conscripted, and then it kind of comes to a head when it's discovered that, you know, deep state government, military, industrial complex, Supercell has like organized this war to steal technology. But at the same time, like, it is just like cute girls doing cute things as national stereotypes, and their like military characteristics are relatively downplayed. And just to like, I didn't realize, like, it's the sort of thing where I rarely think like this would be better if it didn't have the military aspects. But this is definitely something where like Hetalia did it way better. But I guess it wasn't cute girls, that was cute guys. So that was obviously something else they have to mash into this insane pastiche of magic and technology and specific references to types of machine guns and specific references to World War II aces. And it's really interesting that that's what we start out with. And then we get much more like streamlined stuff where they do take out the war, like Upute and Girls in Panzer. Like in Upute, they're just a bunch of personified machine guns going to school. And in Girls in Panzer, it's just an intramural sport that you play in high school if you're a girl. And So I do think it's interesting that like Strike Witches kind of shows this transitional period where like, oh, we can have the military hardware without having the war that we have to like kind of either vindicate our reasons for fighting the war or show that it was a conspiracy to make us fight a war we didn't have to fight. Instead, we just don't have a war. We just have tanks sitting around and tanks for fun. Yeah. Just drive tanks for fun.
There's a weird way in that Girls in Panzer could almost be considered like the perfect military show, because essentially each team is essentially just a distillation of a particular military doctrine from a specific nation, and or at least the tropes about the doctrines, probably not the actual ones.
Yeah, no, there's I don't think Italy was doing like human wave with shitty tanks in World War II, but I could be wrong.
It'd be funny if they were, anyway.
I mean, I think that's eating pasta, dying en masse, that sort of thing.
But it's that their entire society is based around these battles. You take everything that makes a military, all the propaganda, all the training, all the mechanical fan service, and you remove the actual war, and that's what you get. You get just pure military without any bad taste of war to spoil the cute girls doing military things show. The other thing I was going to say is, like, for culture, the one show I could actually think which does sort of deal with the quieter kind, which John is happy to call propaganda, but I'm not, is one we covered, which is Gundam War in the Pocket, and which is that is very much keep calm and carry on. It's like the toys that he's playing with, it's the cartoons he watches, it's this little, we need to have this naive child's perspective on war shattered before our eyes before we can go, that kid is being encouraged to go, wow, cool robot, but robots are not cool, but they are cool.
Yeah, I've talked at length about my extremely partial, somewhat dysfunctional relationship with Gundam. And honestly, I honestly feel like Mecha's understanding of current conflict and how it tries to map it forward into an imagined future of even more ruinous conflict, which felt fantastical 20 years ago and now feels kind of but speaking of just like the drone attacks against Russian air bases that just happened today, but it is interesting to watch War in the Pocket and to watch a 8th MS team where it is just kind of this quagmire of collateral civilian damage and directionless teams fighting in trackless jungle where like holding territory isn't really a concept. And to still think back to my first introduction to Gundam, which is Turn A Gundam, and how there's a lot of the beauty of military shows where you watch symmetrical forces, and if not symmetrical in terms of hardware and tactics, symmetrical in terms of potential to win the conflict. Mm-hmm. And one of the most interesting things about Turn A Gundam, and one of the things that most problematizes this fantasy, is how in Turn A Gundam it is literal, like, you know, futuristic spaceships and robots from the moon fighting against turn of the 1900s, like biplanes and like shitty proto tanks and like bolt action rifles. And there is still nevertheless like some sort of like weird, like heart thrilling majesty in seeing a biplane flying over a giant robot to try to drop hand grenades on its head. And it's just completely ineffectual, but it does point out that, like, I don't know, there was a thread on Blue Sky, I don't know if I'll be able to find it to link, about how, like, there aren't really, like, decisive battles or decisive defeats. It's about the culture's belief that the war needs to go on versus the war needs to stop, and battles can have a relation to that, but most decisive defeats are made decisive by the fact that the nation cannot recreate its armed forces, or it cannot find a new strategic position that it can force battle. And so in Turn A Gundam, the fact that the moon people can't conquer the entire world, they don't want to, they want to settle in the Sun Belt. And unfortunately that's the territory of like two different nations. And so there's no situation where supreme military power will stop the conflict, or innovative tactics will force the moon people to realize that their plan is not viable. It all takes place in people, and it's one of the interesting things where it's a show intensely about war, where the battles are kind of incidental because they are just symptoms of this breakdown in society and this breakdown in communication. And the fact that Mecha has the ability to like to tell these stories while still being wow cool robot is what makes it wonderful. But it's also something that removes us further from the human cost of the weapons, and the fact that these are that there's this nest of different symptoms creating these situations. And so it's always funny to see War in the Pocket brought up, because it is just like, you think you want to go to war, little boy? Fuck you. War is death and destruction. And taking that a step further,
I'd argue all of the sort of protagonist characters, the central three, are all kids in their own way. Like, the one is an actual kid, but the other two are just fundamentally still kids in this war. Like, one is a test pilot and the other is a raw recruit in a unit. He's protected by the rest of the unit from some of the things they are prepared to take on, not just because they see him as green and incapable, because they just don't quite want to send him forward to kill things yet. Similarly, the test pilots, she, in the same way Anno talks about a robot, she sees this as a machine she's testing, and she just so happens to have been called on to use it in a real fight, and so she's not really fully aware that she's killing someone, and that's part of the tragedy of that particular thing, that the person she ends up killing is the person she's starting to have feelings for in the greater plot of things. Gundam as a franchise is interesting because I don't think it shies away from the fact that in sort of modern quote-unquote total war, civilian infrastructure is part of the war machine. It teaches the next generation of recruits. It makes the bombs and bullets. And as you said, as long as the illusions that propaganda creates that this war is sustainable doesn't break, it maintains the will to fight. And to both sets of belligerents in so many of the different Gundam franchises, that means the opposing society is a legitimate target. The entire one-year war starts off with just billions of civilians getting killed as kind of a gesture by the Zeon. And then one of the most notorious like acts of genocide in anime, that like the colony drop, like where it's so horrendous that it becomes a meme. Like
there are people who don't know Gundam who know the phrase colony drop, which is, I think, the ultimate success of a meme.
And the fact that they call it Operation British, because it's, and the reasoning being it is because it is decolonization, is one of the dumbest naming things in a franchise.
I've never heard of this, but that's really funny. I can't. Okay,
so we're gonna persuade the Federation to decolonize by dropping a colony on them, and therefore we're gonna call it Operation British. Yeah, that's a real thing, apparently.
I love that. Unironically, I think that's one of the best things I've ever heard about anime.
Well, yeah.
But I'm a clown. So
Gundam can be distinctly clown-like at times itself,
that's true.
so I don't think that's necessarily wrong, especially when it comes to naming characters. I'm a Gundam UCE stan, and therefore the particular version of Char we got in that, it was full frontal, and that's pretty difficult to beat, which is a bad combination of phrases. But the sort of end point of that sort of cultural osmosis of war and of the military is that people are ready to be recruited, they're ready to be trained. And like you've brought up the SDF earlier, and I don't think we maybe should just explain what how the Japanese military is different from Western ones before we go any further,
Well,
because
one thing is that they are not allowed to have a standing army, I believe. Is that correct, Ben? You're the expert. Due to the treaty after World War II,
yes, and
but they have the Self-Defense Force, and they work with the U.S. Army, who has multiple bases in Japan. And it is what it is.
yes, I mean, Article 9 of the Japanese Constitution prohibits the country from having a military or using armed force against another member of the international community.
But they're allowed to have a
But
defense force, technically.
yes, and they can be invited through certain defense partners to participate in certain military operations. It is. I don't know. It's been a source of political turmoil for Japan for some time, with like the 60s and 70s protesting against the renewal, and since the 2000s, people saying that Article 9 shouldn't exist and Japan should get a military just like everyone else. And they're supposedly not allowed to develop like cruise missiles or long range ballistic missiles, but they have them now. So for counterattacks.
I think it's interesting because partly because I think the SDF and those rules around it have within Japanese media in particular created this fascination for like special forces, as John emphasizes in Gate, this idea that we have this one unit and they're allowed to do the things no one else is. And that, like, you get that in things like Ghost in the Shell, Pat Labor, or in the case of the one I wanted to talk about, Jinro Wolf Brigade, which specifically sort of is set in an alternate Japan, which where instead of World War II and being ended when for them being ended when Japan is invaded by the US, Japan is invaded by Germany. So the German culture takes over. Everyone is driving Beetles, using Lugers, and their post-war special forces just happens to look a bit like stormtroopers with really cool guns and ballistic armor. And that's not because someone really just
Just funny, because if you want to look badass, you do not want to look like a stormtrooper.
What if a stormtrooper, but their armor's black and they're really buff?
Oh, you mean Death Troopers?
Dark troopers.
I think it's interesting because like Jinro is a Mamoru Oshii film, and like he does like that tension between when the rules of engagement of a particular organization click into place, and he always creates these thrillers around it, like figuring out when are we allowed to do what we want to do. Jinro's plot is basically about this unit within Japan's SDF creating a reason for itself to exist, like basically manipulating people to create a situation where its continued existence is justified. At the same time as that grander meta plot of it's interested in the idea that everyone has this basic aversion to killing. We have this innate line in ourselves, and what has to happen to someone for that line to be broken? And once it's broken, how can you ever go back to being a normal member of society again? You have this difference between a paramilitary and a military's rule of engagement. You get this young soldier traumatized by a suicide bomber. We're initially set up, oh yeah, he's just seen a young kid kill herself, and like that's obviously going to traumatize anyone. And later on, the twist of it is that not that he's necessarily is what has fully traumatized him, it's that he wasn't able to pull the trigger. He hesitated, and that put other people in his squad and himself in danger. And it, mm-hmm. and he so much of his identity is bound up in being this soldier. That reversion to normal, this reversion to the state that 99% of the world is in, where killing someone is a horrific and almost unthinkable action for us. That's what traumatizes him. That's what makes him freak out. It's wait, I could have been this, but that's not who I am. And it's a very nihilistic take on it. And I feel like that's an interesting thing, because we're often shown how people are trained to operate machinery, to shoot guns, to hit targets. But with very few works which are interested in how do you get someone to pull that trigger? And once you get them to pull that trigger, how do you get them to go back to society afterwards where that's not what they do?
Yeah, this is something we struggled with a little bit also, with just like where to draw the line for this topic, because militarized police is a very popular topic in anime. And if we're doing Jinro, then it's just a little step further to Ghost in the Shell and Dominion Tank Police and Pat Labor. And suddenly, like, any show where someone has a gun, you know, like Horus Recoil, becomes a anime about the military. And for me, at least, I drew the line just like where, for what shows, is the hardware itself, is the lifestyle itself. Because one of the things I liked about Strike, which isn't, when I kind of lost my train of thought earlier, forgot about this, is just that it does like focus on dorm life, base life, and not necessarily examining them to the same extent as Jinro, the moral questions that intrude upon your life when you choose to, you know, become the part of an organization theoretically exercising lethal force, but just like the feel of being in the military. And I honestly think that's probably why Girls in Panzer is successful enough to just take a girl's high school and put it on an aircraft carrier and suddenly like, yeah, sure, the military now, I suppose. That's what it's like. There's very little disciplinary hearings. I mean, Strike Witches has a disciplinary hearing and it's just confined to quarters. Like, you disobeyed a direct order and endangered the life of superior, confined to quarters for 10 days. It's fine. We don't need to do a court-martial, do we? So
Jinro has basically, one of the things it starts off with is basically an inquest into this failure to obey orders and him being sent back to basic training, essentially. That's why it made my list, because I felt like that sort of acclimatizing of him back into the system was a side of a military we don't get shown enough. Mm-hmm. The thing which makes someone a soldier as opposed to just a guy in a battle is that ability to follow orders and to do what you're told. That's often what brings on the greatest tragedy of, because they're told to do it. I think that's what defines a person in the military as opposed to just like a warrior in a feudal system or whatever, that first and foremost you're doing what you're told.
Yeah, no, I definitely agree. And like, I think that's what makes this topic more distinctive from just like general stories about war, because like samurai, like there are orders in in the Sengoku Jidai and related things, but it's much more of an affective, emotional process where you owe something to somebody and you're doing this because of that. And the idea, your opinion on the cause and the order shouldn't weigh in upon that, feels like a much more modern understanding of the military, where you kind of, as opposed to devoting your entire being to fighting a war, you're kind of depersonalized into, as you said right at the beginning, like a component in a machine as much as a gun or a gear or what have you. And the contrast between the dehumanization of the individual in the modern military and the like incredible sophistication of military hardware, especially when like works start shading into the near future pseudo sci-fi sort of stuff, is a definite interesting part of it.
If you look around in anime, I think along with the sort of quote-unquote modern military aesthetic, I think that the most common ones you'll see is the Germanic and Prussian ones. Mm-hmm. And I think that's partly because that particular military tradition is so strongly associated with discipline and order, at least theoretically. I know, like, in practice, how an army operated is very different. In theoretical, a someone marching in good order with perfect discipline is what makes a good soldier within a military system. Mm-hmm. In British media a lot, around the First World War in particular, that is leads to all this tragedy of just repeatedly sending wave after people to death, like mm-hmm. good soldiers, bad generals, lions led by donkeys, as the phrase goes. It's like, that's why Blackadder is basically considered like one of the most definitive British works on the world First World War, because we see it as such a horrendously dark thing that we have to just lampoon it because it's too grim to actually consider this huge waste of life. What's kind of interesting is that the anime, which sort of deal with that sort of macro level of the way war is run, I think the one which came to my mind was Legend of Galactic Heroes. Mm-hmm. It basically takes the idea that, well, you don't really have heroes in a military. You do have generals, and those generals are individuals who truly can make a difference with their actions in a way that an ordinary trooper can't. And so those are the pivots on which war turns. And so you have this work which very much deals with like the few individuals who matter and the systems which those individuals exist in, because you've got your protagonist Yang Wenli and your antagonist Reinhard von Loganheim, and they're both prodigies, they're both incredible commanders, mm-hmm. and their armies are fairly evenly matched in firepower and manpower, but they're in different political systems. The Federation Yang's part of is just a democracy like we know currently and hopefully continue to know.
I love this disclaimer. Remember when we started this podcast before democracy started overtly crumbling? Oh my god. But, 2015. Obama years, yeah. Jesus,
and maybe that's the naivety of Legend of Galactic Heroes. That part of what makes the Federation interesting. Yang is this genius. He's part of this system. His ascent to power is slowed by the constraints of law and by the democratic institutions around him. And he also is a product of that society and does not have a personal lust for power. Whereas Reinhard usurps control of the Imperial Galactic Empire because that's what his society has encouraged in him. It's encouraged ambition. Mm-hmm. It hasn't built any structures to limit that growth. And so he's free to carry out war as he wishes, theoretically. And he's ruthless and determined. But without those structures which stop others rising, he's stuck dealing with others who are almost as talented as him, almost as ambitious, and who one day think, yeah, maybe I want to be the one who's going to sit upon that throne. And so you have this battle of these two systems. It's determined by the society that the person exists. And where that will to fight comes from, how a democracy can still find the structural stability to fend off a dictatorship. And let's hope that's a truism, because that's more less theoretical than it used to be.
And just the injection of martial idioms into politics in general, the understanding of like various political movements as being an army or being a war. Mm. It is really interesting. Like I was thinking while you were talking, especially about how like, it's funny how many of our stories, our sci-fi stories, our stories about looking forward to the future are about us fighting a war, about our ideals in the present. And I think, unfortunately, that's just kind of the nature of humanity, but it's also something that like, it's hard for us to imagine us ever putting these toys away, because they seem like such a problem solver, at least under certain circumstances. And then within living memory, they have solved some very major problems for human civilization. Although maybe solve is saying too much, because they're back, but it is, just living in a society where we have all this Pete Hegseth warfighter nonsense. Mm. Like how do we understand, is the military a roadmap for how like a perfectly orderly organized society is? Is it a cancer that we can't cut out because it's too deep in our bones? Like, what the way that we reckon with our violent tendencies, with us being one of the few species of living creature to invent war, to invent genocide, to invent something more elaborate than a rock that you hit someone in the head with to stop them from disagreeing with you. It's a tension I can never let go. Like, when I'm thinking back to Zipang and its conviction that, like, that something good could have come out of Japanese imperialism during World War II, given the right technology, the right morality, the right people seeing the right levers to pull. It seems right, but it's seductive. I don't know. It's a poison that makes you keep drinking it. Like John has said about implicit propaganda, I can't help but worry that I'm maybe drinking a bit too much, that I have an addiction. When I'm waiting for that next Girls in Panzer finale movie, I'm gonna be in my mid-40s when that series is done, and I'm not prepared to cope with at least the rebuilds are done. Those are the two. That was the other movie series where I'm like, wow, I'm going to be a significantly older human being when I finally see the end of the story.
Yeah.
It's something I grapple with, because I fucking love tanks. I just love looking at them. Love watching them drive around. I think that Girls in Panzer has kind of gone off the deep end with trying to make a season of TV that is six movies spread out over 14 years or whatever.
That's insane. I don't know what they were thinking.
And if there's ever guns in a preview for the next season, I'm always going to be like, should I watch this? And the answer is no. It's based on like a gachapon game, and you will not be satisfied with the level of military fan service. But it's still like, it's something I really question, because I'm drawn to how we understand our violent selves, the dark shadow that we can't help but cast over our own history. But is anime the way to process that? I mean, obviously it's one of the ways I process it, because I can think of just so many shows that I love, and it's just like, it's about people screaming at each other that they don't want to kill each other while also trying to kill each other. And like, I don't know, maybe if I'd watched like Allison and Lilia or one of these like chiller, more like pseudo World War One sort of, I don't know, like, was it Dragon Pilot? That was also one that was just kind of like, oh, it's like, you know, chill fantasy healing.
I mean, look, one of my favorite shows of all time, not an anime, is Stargate SG-1, and that's military as fuck. It's colonialist. Like, they are basically traveling to other worlds and saying, hey, you know what? We could do this. We can do this better. Listen to us. We're your saviors. So, you know, it's not like anyone's immune to it.
Yeah. And that's, I mean, is that better or worse than like the cockpit OVAs, which are just openly pro-Axis stories of like incredible things happening to Japanese and German pilots in World War II? Which the final one is an attempt to nuke America in a captured B-17. Like, wild. But at least it's open about it. It's not packaging it as like some like inevitable future. It's at least looking backwards at something that's no longer a thing, or at least is notionally no longer a thing.
Yeah. I mean, I think we're lucky in some ways because Miyazaki exists. And to have the biggest auteur in a genre be avowedly and openly anti-war, and to have a familial history with the war, which he explores in his work, and he will explore his own fascination with militaria, I think rubs off on everything around him. Like, obviously, being on the losing end of a war does that as well, because Japan has seen what it's like to lose a modern war in a way that the USA in particular and Britain to a lesser extent have not. Like, one of the things I did as part of my prep for this was, okay, let's have a look and see what the non-anime equivalents of things are. And it's incredibly notable that America put out a absolute slew of Vietnam Wars films, and that the one war you notably lost is the one which consumes you in terms of your culture. It's the one you keep coming back to, because that's where the trauma is. But strangely, this is kind of war associated rather than military, but you have things like Grave of the Fireflies and Barefoot Gen within the anime canon, like these effects of that of war on civilians. But the British media canon really has nothing about the Blitz. Absolutely no films made about how some of our largest cities were bombed into near rubble in the Second World War, because we won, and that justifies everything. Whereas when you lose, the futility's there, and it's obvious. All this suffering for nothing. All these people who didn't come back, that was for nothing. And that can't help but change your national reaction to something.
Oh, yeah. I mean, and even more so, just like, if you look at the comments from the Imperial Army, especially at the end of the war, like, they were saying it's better for Japan to be destroyed than for us to like give up our warmonger. Like we made a go, and this country should be turned to a desert rather than be forced to live with whatever like surrender and demilitarization is possible. And obviously the lie was put to that, but it is very interesting that like those people got their chance and they drove the nation off a cliff. For the most part, I don't know, there's the War Dead Shrine, which kind of is an uncomfortable little burr in the saddle of this thesis, but it does generally seem like the supremacy of peace, the ultimate desirability of peace, is definitely an accepted premise. And even in Zipang, where we have this fantasy of like a greater Japan co-prosperity sphere existing from World War II into the modern era, there is an acknowledgement like this causes less death and it stabilizes East and Southeast Asia to the point that there is, you know, not, you know, the Korean War and the Vietnam War don't happen on the same scale. And peace is always the argument. And sure, like the argument for Trump's deportations is, you know, more peace, less crime, et cetera. But this does seem to be like relatively closely held that we've learned something from the horrors of the 20th century.
One of the other shows I watched for this was Last Exile, which is, I think as you describe, Ben, is very much a pastiche militarily.
More of a pastiche even than Strike Witches, yeah.
Yeah, which is saying something. But it likes this idea of fighter combat, but it wants to set it in a science fiction thing, so everyone gets this special engine which makes things float, so you don't actually need wings. Mm-hmm. But it has, within this show about heroic fighter pilots, has some characters who very much do not conform to the idea that this fight is a good idea. These two side characters, like one of them, Lavi, who is the navigator, the co-pilot to our lead Klaus. She's smart, competent, if a little greedy, as the tropes would have. But she basically refuses the call. Like they had previously just been basically couriers, and when she sees Klaus piloting it as a weapon of war, eventually decides basically that she can't be part of that. She has to sort of step back and to make this break with this person she loves and has been a part of her life since childhood. Mm-hmm. And it's so rare that you see someone just go, no, actually, I'm not going to fight. That's not what I'm going to do. And the other great little side character is a guy called, with the excellent name of Merlin Shetland. So Last Exile has a very convoluted story, but part of it is this wider context of two nations fighting over dwindling resources with this formalized combat with rows and rows of steam-powered musketeers lining up to shoot at each other, and with rules governing what is an acceptable loss rate before one belligerent is declared victorious. And we are introduced to one of these musketeers, Merlin, whose attitude reminds me more than any other character I've bumped into of the what we hear from all the accounts of World War One veterans. Like, he's not concerned with kills, he's not concerned with victory, he's concerned fundamentally with survival, and not in a way that is cowardly, in a way that is just practical. He knows that the majority of people who are going to step out onto that field are not coming back. He has this little prayer before battle, and which isn't like, I pray for victory, it's like, may bullets pass my body by. That's a different character. I think probably one which couldn't exist outside being a side character. I think it'd be a diff. I don't think you can have a main character who does that, maybe. but it's interesting that you have these two people who are prominent within the show who just in different ways reject the idea of being part of a military machine. One just actively refuses it, and the other rejects their notions of what he should be aspiring to do. And it's very appropriate that the resolution of his arc is when the two warring countries eventually combine against the organization which was pitting them against each other. He ends up marrying a soldier from the other force. He's someone who can see himself in the troops on the other side in a way that you hear so often early in the early years of World War One, particularly, where you'd have the Christmas truces are mythologized to a certain degree, where people would go across the lines, exchange rations, play football, even famously. Those were immediately cracked down upon. It was made sure that they never happened again, that people did not fraternize with the enemy. And for our main military veterans' point of view to be insubordination and marrying one of the enemy, I think it's good and it's different.
Yeah, yeah. Love blooming on a battlefield is kind of underrated because so often they go for a faceless enemy. Yeah. And I do think Last Exile does right by having a much more berserk style, like eternal war between two polities that are just fighting forever over this borderland. And like, if I remember right, it's been too long since I watched Last Exile. And I actually tried to rewatch it about a year ago and just didn't grab me this time around. But there's like an atmospheric effects that keep them necessarily from just easy conquest, just why they have to have these goofy airships. It is very common in anime with a lot of shooting to have the main character be someone who Joseph Campbell style refuses the call to adventure by refusing to fully immerse themselves in the military context. Cause like in Strike, which is Miyafuji, the main girl, likes to heal, and she's like, I will never point a gun against another person, which is fine because the Niroi, the aliens, are
persons,
all like weird geometric
shapes. I can shoot them all I like.
Yeah, and guess what? Guess what the huge twist is? One of them assumes a human shape in episode 9, and that's like the crisis there. And a fine one. Like, as much as it wasn't the twist they wanted it to be, I can never fault some piece of fiction that's like, what if the things that don't look like people are still people? I think that's a question that more people could be faced with when they are growing up, or even when they are adults. So yeah.
What if one of those people looks like a pig, Ben? Like. I think Porco Rosso is fairly beloved by this podcast, and we've talked about that particular interwar air adventure before. Within the military, I find that interesting in that it's kind of post-service. It's someone who went to war for his country in something he could believe with, and he lost his closest friend in that war, and now he finds his country turning towards a thing he finds abhorrent, the mode of flight that he loves equally turning abhorrent. And so what was this sacrifice for? What did this good man die for? Could I have died in his place? All these questions he has, which he will never be able to fully resolve. And how we're not often shown veterans who are traumatized in a quiet way. It always has to be, oh god, they saw their best friend torn apart, gun in front of them, and not just my friend didn't come back.
That was unfortunately the repeated disappointment of Strike, which is when we see these people with the veterans, they're always just like, I'm traumatized because I liked a boy and he died, so no one's allowed to fraternize with the base crew, which is a fun way to make sure there's like a minimal number of men in your like girls with airplane legs anime, but there are so many other instances where like nothing specific happened to a person. I when I was going through confirmation at my childhood church, back when I decided I wanted to pretend to believe in God, who tutored me was part of a flamethrower team on Iwo Jima, and he saw me like doing like little like war doodles, and he was just like, hey, don't do that. And that is an extremely quiet trauma, to the point that I think previous generations might not even consider it trauma. But like, it's hard to do that in anime. Anime is often so much about big emotions and big ideals, and just watching a 70-year-old man just express like firm, unelaborated discomfort with just, you know, a 10-year-old kid doodling warplanes and bombs being dropped and stuff. It's hard to cover all the tiny aspects of war. And so the big ones, the dramatic ones, that I had a fiance and he flew off on one last flight and got super blown up. Even in anime, that there's a sense of inevitability that I don't think is present in war too, where like some, like the aging major, apparently if you can get too old to be a strike witch, because the major is 20 and her shield isn't as effective anymore, and she's like losing her magical powers, which is apparently a natural process. And her teammate's like, hey, stop going up there, like there's gonna be a bullet you can't block with your witch magic. Fucking anime. There's gonna be a bullet you can't block with your witch magic, and I don't want to see you die. And like, you know from that moment that there's a bullet with her name on it, and unfortunately the actual truth is that there was always a bullet with her name on it, and that's, it's hard to tell a story about that and not have it be a massive fatalist bummer, which I don't know. Maybe there should be more stories like that about war. I don't know if they'd be particularly successful on the market, but it's something I think about.
I think, like, as you say, like the moment you put on any uniform as part of the military, you've put a potential countdown to that bullet you don't dodge. Another little detail about Last Exile, these musketeers don't have armor of any sort. Mm. They are just in clothes. They're just in uniform. It is just a contest. It is their survival isn't important. It's just an attritional measure. I remember that's a detail. Another thing which reminded me about World War One, how like initially you didn't have like even helmets. Like people at the start of World War One, there was no armor. Like, you'd have these accounts of people saying as they were walking over the top, they would hold their rifles so that the butt was of their gun was over their guts to avoid getting a gut shot. And that was the best you could do to increase your chance of survival. That's a very grim thing to do. And there's probably a good reason we don't get many shows about that. The other thing I was wondering if you guys had any good examples of was just of how the military exists in peacetime.
Yeah, I mean, sailor uniforms or school uniforms, emulating like the Navy and whatnot. Mm. That's the whole thing. Just in general, like there's a lot of emulating of military aesthetics because they look cool in like clothing and whatnot. Not just uniforms.
They convey certain social ideas too.
Yeah.
I think.
That's just saying discipline, order. We want our kids to have those things. Like, we want them to.
Even in like shows that are not about the military, anime specifically, like there's a lot of like embracing of that sort of discipline, like a fucking school club where everybody just lines up in perfect, you know, like perfect order, and sometimes they even salute because that's just what you do. I'm more interested in how the military aesthetics spread to things that aren't to do with the military, just personally. But unfortunately, I don't have any examples because it's so ubiquitous. It just kind of, everything is like that now.
Yeah.
Not just video games, but just like life has so much of it that it's hard to pinpoint specific examples in shows that I've watched, but I know that they exist because sometimes I see them and I laugh. I'm like, I know what you're doing.
Yeah, it's like how Star Wars took like German fascist military aesthetic and just made it kind of like bad guy science fiction. And,
I mean, they were the bad guys too, so that, you know, kind of makes sense.
It's just kind of just lost all meaning and connection. It's just an aesthetic now. That is just it, John. It's just we've had a relatively, within our lifetimes, relative era of peace.
Yeah, sort of, yeah. Yeah, well, I mean, part of it, too, is there's just enough people in the world now that not everybody needs to participate, and we're automating so much more of it. Mm.
I watched a couple of episodes of Akka 13 Prefectures, sort of based on your comments last time, talking about that military aesthetic, because I think you've watched Akka, right, John?
And yeah, it's loved it.
It's about, like, kind of this special police in a... which operates in like this confederated nation, which happens to look like a bird, which is one of the dumbest things in all anime. So yeah, our nation, yeah, just looks like a fucking bird. Just deal with it. That's
weird. So, weird. No explanation.
Because we are a good half century away from the last, well, no, good 75 years now from the last global war. And so all these countries who haven't participated in a war where their own territory hasn't been threatened for many years still have militaries. And Akka is interesting because it's dealing with this country where there is no war going on, but it's still run and policed by a military. And you see how all those aesthetics of the uniforms and of what they come to symbolize of order, and in this case of the end of a war, of this unification of a thing where that this military becomes emblematic of this ability to stop war. That was like the logical endpoint of military doctrine for a while. Like, war becomes so ruinous that no one would ever attempt it. Mm-hmm. And yet people are nibbling at the edges of that.
I feel like that was a big part of like the Cold War, right? Like, nobody wanted to pull the trigger, but then we just decided not to use nukes. And so instead now we have drones because those are better.
Even with the Cold War, like, we have all the, like, we have Arkhipov, we have all these people who are ordered to press the big red button and did not.
Yeah, I refused because they knew, like,
it's hard to see that happening without this institutional memory, because I do think this is like a relatively rare interval of peace. And there are just ideas that just don't go away in the human psyche. Like, the idea that terror bombing civilians reduces a nation's will to fight is completely unsupported. It was the retrospective studies done on bombing civilian centers in World War II proved it didn't really stop military production, and it definitely did not stop people's support for the war, because unfortunately the people bombing them are the people they're fighting against, and the solution to being bombed by the people you're fighting against is to fight back and not to give up. But we have this conviction that we can make humankind tired of war, and I think that only really happens at like a really meta level, and it doesn't stick. It's not passed on genetically or socially.
Yeah, give it 50 years and something real bad's going to happen, basically.
Well, people see no one else fighting, and they're like, okay, well, if no one's fighting, then I can be the only one who fights and I'll get everything. And like, I think that's also a flaw in the human soul, that we can only do a certain amount of things to compensate for.
This aspect of the military in peacetime doesn't conscript people in the same way it does during war. Because you're not being conscripted to fight. You're being promised, oh, you join the army, you have a career of service where you'll learn skills, you'll be respected, you'll get all these things from it. And then suddenly you're at war. And like, that's a tale I've never really seen and told. Like, you always come into these stories mid-flow, like the war already exists. You never see someone who just joins up because, yeah, my granddad was a soldier, and it's a good living.
Military through family is also a big thing that I think
it's a tradition.
Tradition, thank you. Family tradition of military is definitely a thing that gets passed down a lot in real life, for sure. And it's a pretty common thing in stories too.
Last Axel has the two main characters' parents vanish, attempting to deliver a peace message between the two major nations. And part of their motivating arc is to follow in their parents' footsteps. And that's why Lavi, the navigator, is so against Klaus turning to becoming a military pilot, because she sees the legacy of their parents being one of trying to bring peace. For military prestige, it has some interesting inversions. I think We're at the end of our own arc here.
Yeah, I mean, besides just going through my spreadsheet and just bringing up different military anime, I don't think I have a lot more to contribute. Well, with that, let's go ahead and take a break, and we'll come back to talk about what we've been watching. We're back. For the second half, we're going to be talking about stuff we've watched, stuff we're watching, perhaps some stuff from this season that we've dropped. Who wants to go first?
Well, I wasn't going to talk about this one, but since Duncan said that he hates Witch Watch, I'm going to talk about how I like Witch Watch. I think the last episode I watched...
This is exactly what I want. That's what I was hoping you'd do.
I think the last episode that I watched was one of my favorites. In fact, it's not the latest episode that's aired, but... So there's this crow guy. He is kind of a lazy piece of shit. He really doesn't want to work. He spends too much money. His current landlord, who is the main love interest, Ogre Boy, whose name I don't remember. I don't remember any of their names. Anyway, Crow Guy begs. He gets this part-time job putting screws into boxes. So he gets a big shipment of screws, and he has to put them into smaller boxes that he then ships back out. And that's how he makes money, by doing this handheld sorting, I guess. Is that a thing people do? It must be. I don't know. Anyway, he hates it. So he begs the witch to make him faster so that he can, you know, sort things faster. But that affects his entire life. So his whole life is going 10 times faster than everybody else. So he's stuck in this world where he's eating faster, sleeping faster, sorting screws faster. He does get that done really fast. But then he can't talk to anybody because he's talking too fast and they're talking too slow. So he's like, oh, God, it's a horror movie. And it's really funny because of how much like a horror movie it is, right? Like, in a different show, it could just be a fucking Junji Ito story, really. Like, this guy who's just living too fast and just the entire world around him is really fucked up as a result.
But it's funny. It's not Junji Ito.
Right, right. It's really funny. Like, I mean, horror and comedy are basically the same thing in a lot of ways, right? It's just, like, how you present it.
Truth. Wisdom.
I was not wise. I think I stole that from somebody. Anyway.
Remembering relevant quotes is wise. Otherwise, I'm a moron. Yeah. So.
Fair enough. Okay. I'll take it. But yeah, I think Witch Watch is really good. And I'm not normally a big rom-com guy, as everybody who's present here knows. I just don't give a shit about romance about high schoolers. It's the least interesting thing to me. I was actually really excited when I watched the first episode of Witch Watch, and they talked about graduating, but then they immediately were like, oh, right, it's middle school they graduated, now they're going to high school. My bad. Fucking what an idiot I was for thinking that it might be about an adult. Anyway.
Never, John. Never.
It's still good.
Wait, so they're a teen landlord?
It's not. Okay, landlord was sort of a joke. He's hosting the witch and the crow boy, who is there to help the witch because they're just friends. They're just friends living together, basically. It's not literally a landlord.
Yeah, he's a tengu, and he's an ogre, and they're both...
There's no reason for them to be in high school besides just that's the demographic.
Right, exactly, yeah. Like, it is, like, effectively, like, most of it anime. Doesn't take place in the school, but, you know, it is what it is. It's anime.
I love it when anime just gestures to things it can't be bothered to flesh out. It's like, they go to school. They've got parents.
I mean, to be fair, there are, like, every episode is, like, three skits, basically, right? Like, it's one of those shows. So sometimes they're in school, and, like, she's dealing with... Or she's, like, helping out, like, classmates with her spells or whatever. That's basically the gist of the show, is she's trying to be a helpful witch, because when she helps people, it feeds back and makes her magic more powerful and stable or something. I don't know.
She levels up.
Basically, yeah. she's grinding experience through her classmates.
Yeah.
Anyway, I think it's a good show. I know Duncan's bored by it, but I like the gag format, so it's my jam.
I guess I want a dramatic through line more in my shows than it provides. Like, I either want something which is entirely a sketch show, like, which is just like, here's a joke, punchline, go. Joke, punchline, go.
Torture Princess feels similar to this, and I'm surprised.
I think that it mostly is that, to be honest. Like, there's a little bit of her pining after him and him not really getting it, because that's the way these things go, because it's fucking anime and they can never be honest with each other. But that's also... That also fuels the comedy, and that's what I'm here for. I mean, I get that you're here for drama, and I'm here for comedy. We're different people. We're enemies. Whatever.
maybe the difference is that with Torture Princess, I got a lot of Sakuga as well. I got a lot of nicely animated stuff, whereas I feel like this is functional.
See, that annoyed me, unfortunately. Yeah, like, Torture Princess has great art, and I just wish it was attached to something... I don't know. I don't know what... The anime we're currently talking about, how the quality of its art is, which one?
It's competent. It's fine. It's not a bad looking show by any stretch. It's just not a great looking show either.
It's crime though is to have a fabulous looking OP.
Yeah, the OP is great. I would argue that's 99% of anime though. You find an OP that looks great and you watch the show, and most of the time it's going to be like a fraction as good.
That is true. That you will rarely find a show which lives up to its
It is
OP.
a really good OP though. I'll grant it is one of the better OPs out there in general.
Sometimes that's an anime's legacy.
I'm not big on the song. The song's pretty generic, but just like what's happening on screen is chef kiss. Chef kiss. And I wasn't going to talk about it after Witch Watch, but really good to girl. I just kind of want to translate into it. It's also a romance thing about high school age students, but it's a romance fantasy. And like, listen, I read a lot of romance fantasy comics, but they're mostly Korean and they mostly are about adults mostly. And I think that that helps me a lot because they're like 20, they're like of age, so to speak, in fiction. Like that's a whole thing, they go through their debutante ball. I have become a fan of that setup. A lot of it though is because, and even when it's not comedy, and I think a lot of that is because there's more to it. There's an angle to the story, to the characters, that is more interesting than just pretty girl marry pretty boy. You know what I mean? I'm particularly fond of the revenge angle. That's just something I've come to really enjoy. I don't know why. There's no part of my life that I feel like I need to get revenge on people. I'm not that kind of person. I'm a little vindictive sometimes, but I'm not like out there to hurt somebody. But I love reading it. I love reading those stories. And then there's the Gorilla Gods Go-To Girl, which is a romance fantasy and has none of that. And you think that like the gimmick of this girl who has received the Gorilla God's blessing, which makes her super strong, even though she's like this dainty little twig. She's a twig and she's just like super strong. She's super fast. She's got all this advantage over everybody else. Even though everybody gets like an animal's blessing, the gorilla's blessing is known to be the best blessing. And she's like a little ashamed of it because she doesn't want to be a soldier, but she gets drafted into being a soldier anyway. That's like a perfect formula for so many interesting things to happen, and they just don't do anything with it. It just turns into the most boring romance. Like, there's this stupid Ojo-sama who bullies her, and like, she doesn't care. She's like, oh, it's fine. Like, I don't, it's fine. And then bully finally.
Oh, just something good though.
She's a horrible Ojo-sama too. She's not an interesting or fun one.
Oh.
Usually Ojo-samas are great. What is this one? She sucks. And then she apologizes at one point. Like, I don't even remember why. There was no good reason for her to apologize. She hadn't done anything different. She was just continuing to be a bully, and she's just decided this time, no, I'm not going to be a bully. And the main character forgives her because, of course, she did, because she's so nice and precious.
Strike Witches has a French girl bully, Ojo-sama, who also sucks. If they're not fun mean, if they're just mean and cowardly, I don't
Yeah, exactly. Like,
know.
and she's got all these guys fawning after her. The one thing I will give to it is that in the middle of the series, on episode 7, they confess to each other, and they even do a little kiss. It's amazing. But then, of course,
Wow.
they got to keep their relationship secret because she's afraid that everyone's gonna like bother her because she's now dating the hottest boy on campus.
Secret relationship could go places, though. I don't know.
It could, but it's not gonna.
It sounds like very stock.
It is every hitting every single fucking trope in the least interesting way possible. And her gorilla blessing comes into play like once per episode.
Like clockwork.
It's just so boring.
You just wanted her to be in gorilla mode more, is the problem.
Nobody who's working on this has got to be proud of it, right? Like, it's really bad.
That's brutal, Jesus.
You bringing that up has actually reminded me of something, which is that I watched My Next Life as a Villainess, All Roads Lead to Doom, the movie.
Forgot about that. Oh, I need to watch that.
I wish I could forget about that, because sadly, everything that we liked about My Next Life as a Villainess pretty much goes by the wayside. It's been so long since we talked about Villainess that it was at the forefront of what has actually become a strange trend, which is the villainess trope, the Ojo-san turned good.
That's a very common thing that I enjoy in the comic realm too. I think comics are easier though because they're faster. You don't have to wait so long for things to happen.
Oh, pacing in all of these, like, I was excited to have, villain perspective isekai. That seems fun. But the way it just got so quickly driven into the ground, and all of them have terrible pacing, slime, villainous.
I think the first season of Villainess had reasonable pacing, and most of all, Bakarina is a good protagonist. Her developing a strategy and just being like, I'm sticking to this. I do not care what else the world tells me of how I'm being perceived. Head down, eyes forward, going to my goal. And her just like steamrolling through a cast and basically seducing every single one of them by accident was actually pretty fun to watch.
Yeah, like romance anime Mr. Magoo.
Yeah, stepping on hot rakes.
Yeah, I liked the first season of that. I did not watch the second one. I know that y'all kind of fell off of it over time.
It goes nowhere. It is just wheel spinning and fan service. And it sounds like the movie is wheel spinning and fan service.
The movie is wheel spinning and fan service and exotic foreign prince trope. So there's a circus comes to town, and the performers they're exotic. They're from like an Arabian country, and they're doing acrobatic dances and belly dancing, and there's a tiger, and there's a boy dressed as a girl, and these are exotic and different things which no one can could possibly expect. And Bakarina obviously befriends them, because Bakarina does as Bakarina does, and it turns out one of these circus performers is in fact a prince, and that prince has been cursed, and in fact, he is a love interest in a different Otomi game, and he has a bad end. And so this is about her trying to get rid of his doom flags. And that's the twist.
That's interesting.
Yeah, but it's not, John. In theory, it is. In theory.
If it wasn't connected to the Bakarina lineage, I think it would be an interesting one of just like someone crosses over from a different game. And they've like completely hacked their game, and now they're gonna bust apart the protagonist, or I guess the deuteragonist. But Katarina's already insufferable. She already is invincible. I don't know.
Yeah. The whole cast is assembled to help her out, and there's like love interest with him teased, and the brain council of mini Bakarinas is called into being again, which is always fun. But that's about it. It's got some average animation. You know how like there's this standard of animation, which is anime film spin-off, which is just a little bit more shiny, but not breathtaking in any way, shape, or form. Just a little smoother, a little bit more polished. And this is very much it. I wish it had a bit more to say, but it just doesn't. It's just here's her doing for someone else as she did for herself, as linked to the fact that she's making everyone fall for her again as ever. But the one thing which absolutely infuriated me, and which made me think of I think a discussion we've previously had about these OVA films, is at the end every motherfucker gets mind wiped. They're not going to remember any of this.
The men in black show up. The men in black show up and flash everybody.
It's really funny that that's a literal thing in this case.
It's the Dark Phoenix, which was going to go wild and kill the prince, is charmed by Bakarina and helps them in, but says, I'm afraid you cannot know my dark secret, because otherwise everyone would come after me again and what seek my power, and therefore I must make you all forget.
So it didn't matter at all.
Yeah. Motherfuckers.
Oh my god.
It was like...
I remember reading online people said that season two was boring because they were saving all the good parts of the light novel for the movie. And to hear the movie is what you just said. It's hard liking anime.
So wait, is the movie quote-unquote canon? Is it...
Who knows, John? It's canon, but it's not canon. It's have your canon and eat it, John, frankly. It's like...
Really eat that canon. That's not a pleasant
image. It might
be.
Ooh, could this be canon? Maybe.
That's...
Maybe canon. If you ask nicely, it's canon.
Wouldn't it be wonderful if they had a plot like two seasons later where they reduce the mind... They remove the mind wipe and suddenly remember the whole movie and have to deal with it. That's definitely...
I'll say that mind wipe thing sounds like a funny Excel Saga episode. I'll say that much.
True, yes. But it's not. It's an hour and a half long rather than 20 minutes, and that's why it is not funny. It is not a 20 minute OVA which picks one dumb gag and then just runs with it. What is a good 20 minute OVA which picks one dumb thing and runs with it is the two super OVAs which have come out. Actually, I do say two. Actually, only one of those is good. Yes. One of them is absolutely appalling, and just this is both the problem and the genius of Konosuba, is that it will take one idea and it will run with it, and it will either drive that idea into the ground until you are just utterly sick of it and you just wish it would fuck off, or it will actually just make you roll on the floor in laughter because it just nails it. And the first one of these two, where there's this recurring trope in Konosuba that all the natural disasters are embodied by actual sort of gods. Winter was General Winter, and this is like the Lady Typhoon. Like, it's every year this typhoon goddess comes to the outskirts of Axel, and the adventurers go out to fight her. But here, John, is the twist. Because she's so angry, she sends out these huge gusts of wind, and it blows off all the lady adventurers' clothes. And therefore, all the men adventurers look forward to this event every year. But no, Aqua gets it.
The worst of Konosuba. Konosuba's worst impulse is embodied.
Yeah. And so the entire episode is the male adventurers letting Kazuma in on this secret, and him being like, "Okay, I'm gonna play along with this. This is my thing, and this is what I want to see." And then him gets it getting spoiled by Aqua being able to understand the goddess and basically trying to talk her down and being like, and then Aqua being Aqua just completely failing and getting her even more enraged to the point where they actually have to fight her. But it's just terrible. It's the worst of Konosuba.
The only funny joke is when Cosmo's like, "Oh, gods aren't real. Like, these are actually atmospheric effects." And Aqua being like, "Actually, no, Cosmo. In here, gods control the weather. Like, no, like you, your scientific logic doesn't apply in this reality." It was actually like that was funny, and then it just completely pissed away a decent premise with just horny fan service.
But what is a good premise is that what if there was a group of adventurers who had incredibly close names to yours and who were actually the competent mirror of your group? What if there was a Kazuma who was actually a heroic adventurer? What if there was a Megumi who was an excellent mage? A Akir who was a kind and benevolent healer? And what if Lackless was the name of your brave crusader? Like, this group of actually competent heroes who reflect, who show you up for the absolute scumbags you are by flouncing into town and actually being competent. And because I love like how they come to town and they've got annoyed because the normal group are getting confused with them, and so that all the bad things Kazuma does is rubbing off on this other person's reputation, and they're where's this Kazuma? And Kazuma's like, I'm not Kazuma, I am Nakamura. I can't remember what he actually calls himself, but he just makes up a name on the spot, and he's just like, no, you just buy me dinner and I'll tell you all about this Kazuma who's been doing it. And he just spins this tale of the most heroic possible interpretation of himself to them utterly shamelessly while they ply him with food, and by then they're like, "Oh, this poor Kazuma, like he's truly is a hero." Then they actually get informed of who he is, and it's like, you ripped us off. You got a free lunch out of us. What? How dare you do this? He's like, "Nope, just close the door on you. Goodbye." And then Megumin and Aqua become aware of them, and Megumin, being Megumin, is just like, "Well, what good are you? Like, you couldn't possibly be as good as us." And then they're like, "We'll show you we can do this." And off they do, and they're actually competent. They do all the quests. Axel becomes peaceful because they're actually killing all the monsters around rather than causing even bigger disasters by fighting them. And so that they actually become liked by the other few people rather than just sort of like tolerated and occasionally fated.
Uh-huh.
And it's just them looking at the others and thinking, "Oh, I wish I had that one instead of our one."
Yeah. I still think that ultimately the execution's middle of the road for quality, but there are a lot of extremely funny jokes, and especially the clowning on the names. Megumin's like doppelganger being Megumi, and she has the weird name because that's a Japanese name that's not in the setting, is extremely funny. Everyone agreeing that Darkness's name is Sinister and her like having a breakdown over it. And then she asks Megumin if her name is cringe, and Megumin's like, "No, it's a super cool name." One of the funniest jokes in the series, but I think unfortunately they're it's a mid-tier episode for me. But Rival Adventuring Party is one of the funniest jokes fantasy comedies have. I'm glad Konosuba has one. It is ground that should have been tread, and they did a decent job.
It's also something like every sitcom about shitty people does too. Like, yeah. I'm sure It's Always Sunny has an episode of doppelgangers. like somewhere in there.
Yeah.
It's good stuff contrasting terrible
It's
people.
comedy gold because you get to have unself-aware people have to confront themselves in the form of another person and realizing that they don't like themselves
Yeah.
Yeah.
or that they have trouble justifying their actions if it's not them doing them. It's a good idea and it's well executed. Darkness does not always land for me because I don't know, the BDSM jokes are mid, but her like being humiliated by hearing other people confirm that her name is lame is very
I
funny.
think that particularly works well because one of the recurring jokes is that she hates her actual name. She hates being called La Latina.
La Latina, yeah.
And it's like, oh, she's picked this name, and yet no, she's still getting clowned on because she's picked a terrible and edgy
The
name.
only person who thinks it's a good name is the Chunibyo.
Yeah.
Good stuff. I mean, it's nice to like enjoy Megumin. I still haven't forgiven the franchise for the Megumin spin-off. In terms of wheel spinning.
Which Megumin spin-off? You've got two Megumin spin-offs, and they're both bad in different ways. Though I will at least say that the movie is funny in
The movie's
parts.
funny. It's
Yeah.
not the best. It's mid-tier again, but yeah,
Yeah.
like mid-tier Konosuba is pretty. I don't know. I don't watch that much isekai comedy. John could probably speak to it better.
I think mid-tier Clobbersuit is always funny on the level that most things do not manage.
Yeah.
The village life one was just very, very slow moving and not funny, which is not what you sign up for Konosuba, even for a
Right,
spin-off.
right, right. The comedy village life slime is the best slime, so I wish they do a second season of that. Anyway.
But instead, you'll get like the sixth season of the mainline one.
People talking in a circle.
Oh my God, meetings the anime.
So many meetings, yeah.
Well, I watched Zammed, and it was weird to see that I haven't really talked about it much, either in the channel or on the podcast, because it has been a mountain to climb. And the anime it puts me most in the mind of, I did say that it was like Eureka 7, but make it Franks. But honestly, my experience of watching it was more like going back in time and watching a Two Cooler Wonder Egg in terms of like ambition, strength of ensemble, strength of world building premise. Like, sure, it's like aesthetically, it's more Guyver, or Razaphon. Apparently, I've never actually watched in full. Would that be worth it? Would it be worth it to watch Razaphon? That's a no. Okay. I just know it's Evangelion. I know Evangelion, so I know
Yeah.
Razaphon is how I consider it.
You've already skimmed off the cream of that sort of era of mecha shows with
Yeah, Gonzo.
and
Gonzo knockoffs.
so you don't need to go back to it and get the cheap knockoff. You do not need the like if Eva walked into a room and Razaphon was there, it would be disgusted by what it found.
We have Eve at home.
Yeah.
I liked a lot of Zammed, but as far as protagonists refusing the call to action, as I like mentioned in the first half, he's fine. He gets like blown up in a bus and it turns him into like a weird biological monster. And there's this mysterious girl from this tribe of like strange magic workers who like raise these alien souls that are used in their military technology, and this like neutral island gets invaded. It's got a sprawling cast. There's a beautiful run of episodes where most of the characters are on this mail ship traveling between the North and the South. It's another Last Exile style
Yeah.
divided world. And then that cast kind of gets blown to the four winds, and the parallel stories about this military breeding program where the more mechanized side is trying to build its own biological weapons. It's got a lot of great ideas. And then the ending is the one of the most incoherent things, where it's just like idea, 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 idea. It felt like they had another season of ideas and they just kept dropping them. And I don't know if that's necessarily what happened, but introducing this emperor who's like the source of all these, like this weird biological technology and this kind of annihilatory instrumentality and the way it resolves and then time skips. It was a fascinating experience, but wildly unsatisfying because it just kept raising questions in the finale, which is why I compare it to Wonder Egg, raising questions about the nature of this technology and like who has been wronged here in this war, and trying to make the like military officer who's been like driving this extremely unethical research program, trying to sympathize him, make him sympathetic. And it's one of the pleasures of watching anime that you watch this thing and you're like, I don't know how I feel about that because its ideas are so unrealized on this like sprawling level. There's just so much ambition there. And there's like an absolute insistence on following this dramatic arc in a way that doesn't like resolve a lot of the questions. And it's funny. I feel like it makes sense that it was released digitally.
Yeah, because Zand obviously has this strange notability about being a PlayStation anime. Mm-hmm. It was released for streaming on PlayStation originally rather than being a broadcast anime, which is a very strange place for it to exist. As you were saying, maybe it was supposed to be 3 seasons and it got cancelled, so they had to jam anything.
I feel that same way about like the Escaflowne rumors that it was supposed to be longer. I don't think so. I think just like the director got to the part of the script where there was just a few like summary sentences and ended up cramming way too many ideas in there. And it's kind of fun. Like, I feel like often anime don't keep adding to the premise in that way, where we're just kind of like learned slowly this like neutral island that's mostly like our current technology, and then discovering this technologically advanced side on one side and this like bizarre alien contagion side on the other side. Like, good ideas developed, and then just deciding that like the finale, just like a lot of stuff has to happen and we have to have a lot of revelations. And that's why I point to Franks. That's why I point to Wonder Egg. So I kind of point to Eureka 7 too. Like, there's just a lot of like ideas splurging at the end, and you just wish there was more restraint there. And you can make another anime after this where there's like a weird god emperor who has been like birthed through a reality abomination, and that's the root of this technology. The technology can just be there. I don't know. Yeah. I don't know.
Zand owes a huge debt to the Nausicaa manga. This premise of the biological weapons in Zand really mirrors some of the stuff that's introduced in the manga of Nausicaa that isn't present in the anime. You have the god warriors, but within that you have lots of created life. You have these sort of golem-like things, which are basically personally enslaved to the will of the emperor and his priests, and this ancient crypt where all the technology of one side comes from, and which houses like this, spoilers for Nausicaa, this ancient computer which was supposed to rebuild this wasteland once it was habitable again, but has just over the years become corrupted and started to view humanity as part of the problem, and all these questions of, should we have this technology? Mm-hmm. Is technology something we should have abandoned? This civilization's power is not something we should want, that it has just made our wars even more ruinous than they were before, and that we haven't learned our lessons from the past and we're just going to keep repeating them. And I actually have some fondness for Zand.
I mean, me too.
Because, as you say, it has a good cast. Mm-hmm. It has a good cast. So long since I watched it, I cannot give you any character names, Ben. But I like his dad, who's the researcher.
His dad and mom are very good.
Yeah.
Extremely good anime parents. Probably some of the best. The mom's temper and how, like, her tantrums are always, like, really fluidly animated. And there's times where, like, her face, like, has a flash of disgust while talking to him that she tamps down.
Yeah.
Just wonderful Sakuga there.
Just them both being present in a show about, which is focused on a kid.
Right.
Them being people who...
That's definitely rare.
Yeah. Parents not disappeared in some magical accident, or just wander off on holiday, or as in Witch Watch, oh, she's gone into seclusion to learn better magic about a disaster.
Yeah.
Accepting that a big part of young adult life is, I mean, now I've trashed it, so now I can talk about all the things I really liked about it. Because it is like a classic, like B-. Like, it's not even a C. It's just like, it's a very promising. But yeah, like, part of a young life is just having to maneuver around your parents and having divorced parents, not particularly happily divorced parents. They clearly haven't worked on their issues. And until the end, they kind of struggle to accept that this other person loves them. Of course, like, a huge part of your life as a kid is dominated by your parents. And it's so interesting how often anime thinks that part of building a pleasant media experience is about deleting the family. At best, you have a little sister to deal with. Usually, your parents aren't people that you have to consider as a big part of your story. And it's just nice. Yeah, it is very nice. They're both, like, weirdly heroic in their own way, too.
Mm.
Definitely, they seem like just dysfunctional scolding parents. And by the end, they've both risk their lives, often to help strangers who they just think their cause is worthy. And that's, like, nice. It's really well written on the character level, honestly. I don't think there's a bad character in there except, I don't know, the, like, pervert male guy who, like, hits on everybody and is obsessed with working out. But That's just a trope. What can you do? Like, I mean, at least they don't have a flamboyant gay man, I guess is my
let's not get into that. Let's stay well away from that.
Well, okay. Join us next time for our end of season episode. We will have a lot more to talk about than just Witch Watch and Go To Gorilla Girl. Remember, rate, review, and subscribe to us on the podcast platform of your choice. Find us on Facebook, Keyframes Podcast. Find us on Blue Sky, Keyframes Pod. Email us questions at keyframespodcast@gmail.com. And most of all, tell a friend.
Not just any friend, a friend who's in the military. And
I think we have a few military fans.
And like refusing orders because they don't want to do a war crime. Yeah, nailed it.
Yeah, don't do war crimes, kids. Cool kids, don't do war crimes.
That's the upshot. The military is unethical, open borders, et cetera, et cetera. Say goodbye, everybody. Yes.
You wouldn't steal a country, would you? No.
Not unless you're a Legend of Galactic Heroes guy. Cool. Okay, well, that was a weird one. I Strike Witches is at the edge of my tolerance. There were so many times I was just going to screenshot you guys, like, just a girl poon in your face. They're like... 14.
Let me put it this way.
Great. Awesome. Love it. Thanks.
If Gorilla Gods Go To Girl was more horny, it would be a better show.
Oh, no.
That's...
We got it on tape, folks.
Yeah.
God's canceled.
It is absolutely chaste then, is it?
It is extremely chaste.
And yet they kiss.
They kissed.
Yeah.
They kiss.
Is that the price? They can't be horny if
they kiss. But they're doing it in this weirdest pose possible where they're like turning side by side, like... holding hands in front. They're not like, you know, embracing each other for the
kiss. Is that weird dance thing they do at the end of the school festivals thing where
it's basically looks like that. They're sitting down, but yeah, it kind of looks like
that. I hope people would understand my reference.
I figured it out like a little like midway through. Yeah, like it's an awkward kiss. It does not look comfortable.
In fairness, this kiss is working out awkward in some way, shape, or form. Unintentionality is actually pretty real. The moment someone headbutts someone accidentally when I'm going in for a kiss in an anime is the moment I give it a 10.
Have you ever had like a brace lock in anime? Because that would be pretty funny too.
That'd be really funny.
That happened to me once. It really hurt.
Oh, no. Oh, I got Jesus.
But the dude did ask for consent. He said, "Can I kiss you?" And, you know, there's that.
Wow. And she didn't murmur no before getting kissed anyway.
No, she was just like, yeah, let's do this. And they went for it. The only good thing I'll say about that show.
You're too good at making anime sound good. This sounds positive. This sounds like good changes.
One of my favorite parts of this season of Shoshimin is at the end of the first arc, which is about a newspaper club attempting to sort of find out who was setting fires in the local area. It turns out one of our two main characters has basically... took revenge on the boy she was dating by completely setting him up to fail with his deductions on who was doing this thing. And he had previously tried to kiss her out of jealousy because of her friendship with someone else. And her friend's talking to her and she's like, so why did you do this to him? Why did you change from helping this guy you were dating to completely setting him up to fail and feel completely inadequate? And it just cuts to a line on the screen. He tried to kiss me without asking. And it's just like, this kid just got his entire life ruined. And it was like, yes, this is 100% what this character would do. But it's like, yeah, no, you did not just do that. You're right. So,
well, I mean, you might have convinced me to watch the show finally, because that's pretty good.
Oh, wow. Witch Watch is getting 26 episodes. Wow.
What? Really?
Yeah. It's getting 2 quarters.
It's a big franchise.
It's been going for a while. My friend saw the anime and was like, hey, I've been reading this for like 4 years.
Yeah.
And then he's not going to watch the anime because he doesn't watch anime. But
I think it's a Shonen Jump one, isn't it? I
believe so. Yeah, that's the only thing he would be reading it.
It's like... anything like Spy Fam and etc. Like if you're a Shonen Jump thing, you'll get your second season almost guaranteed unless you completely and utterly crash.
Yeah, that's probably true.
Actually, I think you quite enjoyed Kaiju number 8. That's just got its PV for its second season going out.
Yeah, I liked it well enough. It's not like stellar, but it was fun.
A lot of sequels next season.
Yeah.
I feel like that's every other season is just like tons of sequels.
Dandadan, Bisque Doll, Sakamoto Days, which I'm not watching. Please,
yay! Like,
come to my house and
well
arrest
done,
me.
Ben. Well done,
but
Ben.
But on the other hand, fourth season of...
Oh no, you are.
Yeah.
Oh God, it's back.
I can't watch it. I can't. It's the most disappointing romance anime I've ever watched, and I've given it three seasons for anything to happen. I can't watch it. I might read reviews.
Yeah, I was gonna say, what if Andy's like, Ben, they turned it round. It's good. Will you believe him, or will you be like,
that's silk posting. That's classic silk posting.
What if I give you $5?
Yeah.
I would do it for $50 and no less.
Know your value, Ben. Know your value.
All right.